Concession number 17747, Rail 49.
As you approached the new year, 1945, did you have any clear expectations about what was likely to happen to you?
Everybody was expecting the war to finish. I mean, that's quite clear, because the Second Front had been going for, 7 months, and the Russians were already getting close to, I think they were probably already in what used to be called East Germany, East Prussia. And it was a curious mix of still the possibility of battle, certainty of battle, possibility of death. At the same time as the government back home was making arrangements for orders of precedence for demobilisation, they were even at some point early in 1945 telling us the precise level of the gratuity we could expect for X months of service. People were beginning to be loosened up in the army sense, sent home on compassionate leave if they'd been away too long. The regular army was obviously beginning to regroup. For example, one of my first adjutants, the first adjutant I had had in Italy was a regular captain, Jerry Barron, and he was quite suddenly removed and sent home by air, which was a novelty in those days, and probably quite hazardous, but you send home to join a staff gunnery course. So things were in a curious no man's land, to coin a phrase of still war, but peace regarded as inevitable.
Did you find that this peculiar state of affairs led to a reduction in the level of combat motivation on the part of the soldiers?
It must have done. Even if it were not for that situation of not knowing whether it was war or peace, we were in a limbo anyway, because the war was at a low ebb. It was a cold, hard winter. We were stuck in the beginnings of the Po Valley, down off the mountains, a place called Forli, F-O-R-L-I. And we were tending to be billeted in farmhouses where people were still living. They were trying to carry on their normal business, except that a lot of them were in fact evacuees who were using their second home. They were well-to-do people from Bologna, this sort of thing. So there was a tremendous melting pot of emotions and physical surroundings. There were things like concerts. There were regimental sports days, which seems quite absurd when we were still fighting the Germans, but we did have regimental sports days when the weather loosened up a bit from the winter. People were going off on courses. I went on a week's leave in January 45 to Rome with a couple of friends, and this was the time when we were ushered into the... We went to visit the catacombs of St. Callistus, and across the road from there was the notorious place where the Germans had executed 335 Italians in reprisal for a bomb attack which killed about 30 Germans.
That would be the Ardeatine
that
Caves.
That was the Ardeatine Caves. Yes. And it was an extraordinary experience to be ushered into this candlelit, enormous cave by a couple of people guarding it, partisans, I suppose, and shown all of these coffins in a long line, each one with a photograph of the occupant on top, and also a sort of glass-covered bins with pieces of bodies inside which either didn't belong or hadn't been identified. I don't know quite what the date of that was. Yes, it was. It wasn't until the 28th of January, I see from my diary. It started on this Po Valley freezing ride to the station at Rimini, train packed, Eric and I have difficulty getting seats, eventually squeeze in with some air observation post types who get in a stock of cognac and vermouth at Fano, F-A-N-O. We keep warm and have a rowdy party, but at the expense of my stomach. Whilst cooling off from this, have a look at the snow on the Apennines. Wonder how long we shall be in this unheated second-class coach. Arrive Rome 6:10 in the morning. Go to a rest camp 5 miles outside Rome. Get a bus into Rome. Opera tickets. Go to officers' club. Go to a show, which must have been a sort of pantomime thing of Ali Baba by the second Agra must have been something,
Army Group Royal Artillery,
which I missed when it was in Forli. Warmer weather here, more like an English spring, and Rome is very lovely and oh for peace. Wears service dress out on the town. Go to a gift shop in the Alexandra Club, buy postcards, guidebooks, have photos taken in the street. I still have one of those. Meet up with Bill Lowes, who's been on a course in southern Italy. Go to Tosca, Royal Opera House, Teatro Reale. 17 and sixpenny seat. Not a good view.
Was the Roman tourist economy reviving then?
Very much so. I don't think it had died for very long because it was an open city and the Germans took their marks away and we brought our Mediterranean army currency in, and I don't think it ever stopped. I think the sort of commercial edge was blunted a bit by these armies. And the no doubt the feeling of the Roman tradesmen that they had to watch their step. Also, I guess they were overwhelmed by change, as we all were.
How did you get on with the Romans?
Well, they were very good. I mean, those we met, of course, were wouldn't want to put a foot wrong. It was not like ordinary peacetime where you would likely to be treated either civilly or uncivilly, according to how they feel. I mean, people tend to be rather polite to an occupying army, particularly if you're officers. The relationships were better than they had been with the Egyptians in Cairo, which I think I mentioned in some earlier tape. Learning Rome, of course, was a tremendous experience. I had been there, I think, on the way up in August 44, on the way back from Italy to the line. That was rather rushed when I had joined in sort of mass audience with the Pope and so on. This was a tourist visit on leave proper, not just on a day release from being stationed or passing through near Rome. This was proper leave. We went on, touring round the usual rubbernecking Castel San Angelo, went to St. Peter's and the Vatican again, went into the treasure rooms in the Vatican, visited quite a lot of the churches, St. Paul's outside the wall, went to see Shelley's grave in the English cemetery. Wonderful operatic evening, Il Trovatore, in a box, and ended up following that at the officers' club. February 1st, coffee shop at leisure, walk down to the Tiber, look into the Pantheon, the old pagan thing, which, of course, was a totally circular Christian church, take loads of photos. I must have got hold of a film, quite warm, by a cigarette lighter. Commerce was beginning to blossom again. See Russian officers at some sort of theatre show.
Were there any shortages that you were aware of in Rome?
I think everything was short. that, I mean, during the war, both at home and overseas, one's ambitions were very low. You didn't expect to go out and buy whatever you wanted. You conditioned yourself to being grateful for what was there. This was true, I think, all over. Went to most the best entertainment of my life, I note, on the 2nd of February, the opera Carmen, with wonderful music, scenery, ballet, even horses on stage. This is my best leave ever, I noted, on the 3rd of February. Look round St. Peter's, see the treasure room, have a look round Santa Maria Maggiore, then again to the opera house for wonderful ballets, back and sit in the YMCA and chat about youthful pranks and sip Irish whiskey. 4th of February, thick head, stagger to the YMCA for more coffee, walk again to St. Peter's with a couple of friends. Astonished and slightly disgusted by the fact that Mass in St. Peter's was a bit like a fairground, as I've put it, as indeed it still is if you go there. We don't approve, so we go on to the also rather posh restaurant for lunch. I remember having green lasagna there. I can remember it now. It was delicious. See a bit of a film. Delightful dinner at the Orso by a log fire, old world lighting and orchestra. We're very happy. This is last night of our leave, and we're sorry to be going back north. Next morning we had a scare, because when we came to pack we found all our clothes had been sent for laundry. We had to go and recover them, but we got good seats on the train. Wrote letters, mail letter cards on the journey north, quite a long way, stiff mountain climb with two engines pulling, very hot next to the engine, etc., etc. Back to Rimini at 8 o'clock the next morning. Snow has gone, but there is now a thaw and thick mud. Back to the troop, C troop. This is, I think, when I had just gone back from RHQ, where I was assistant adjutant, to do a troop job. And I've only realised, reading this diary again, that this was because, or largely because, I suppose the colonel didn't like me particularly, but he had a strategy, which was to man RHQ with regulars. And I was pushed out to a troop, 254 Battery C Troop, to make way for a young chap who was a regular going in to take my place as assistant adjutant. We had quite a long handover period because we were not heavily in action at the time, so it could be done and was done at leisure.
Was this a direct exchange of functions?
I think it was, yes, I think it was. That's right. He was sort of sticking a pin into the roster and finding out who were regulars and getting them around him. This whether he was doing this as part of a instructions that I would know nothing about from the War Office, I don't know. It could have been that this was a deliberate ploy to give RHQ sorts of experience to people who were going to stay on in the army. It would have made sense.
What was your new job then at C
Troop? Well, my new job was that of a troop leader in C Troop. There were two officers, a gun position officer and troop leader with each troop of guns. And although I think technically the GPO was in charge and I would be number two, in fact, in practice, there was no such distinction. We shared the job of taking charge of the troop in turns, so that one would be on duty all night one night and another the next, or at least on call. And we equally plotted, helped to plot the gun position, the targets, we fired the guns. So it was a couple of lieutenants acting as a partnership in charge of the guns, in charge of four guns.
Effectively, it was a sort of watchkeeping.
Are you speaking about the fact that we were not in action, or the fact
at the time that you would be one watch on and one watch off?
But yes. I mean, in action, much the same would have applied. We would take it in turns to fire the guns. We would take it in turns to plot the targets. We would take it in turns to sleep.
Was the troop up to strength when you got to them?
Yes, they were up to strength, except. I mean, the point being that people were on leave, largely, so we were always under strength, but that was by arrangement, not by shortage. We were doing all sorts of odd things at this time. For example, when we found ourselves out of the line, back in Forley for a period, almost immediately the tomfoolery began, in the sense of officers' gun drill run by the RSM, so that having been in action for 2 years and firing guns at the enemy, we were now required to, is obviously filling in time and part of the army nonsense that there always is, finding things for people to do. It was officers' gun drill for, I think, 2 days running. We went out on pistol shooting, target practice. I'm talking now about still about February 45. The hot sun is beginning now, it's getting warm, sort of continental climate made the fens, the Po Valley rather like the fens during those winter months, but when it did begin to get warmer it happened much more quickly and more effectively. We all had great spates of letter writing, catching up with correspondence. Back at the troop, we were still in contact with the Germans at this time, and I, having been in RHQ for well over a year, I found myself ordering my very first firing for 15 months of a troop at a target.
Do you remember what the target was?
I have no idea at all. No idea.
Were the German positions visible from where you were located?
Well, to an extent they must have been, because I've got a note which rather surprised me when I read it, that we did some firing a week or so later, and we knew that it must have been effective, because we saw Red Cross ambulances going in the same direction after we'd finished.
Presumably, if you were in the foothills and they were down on the Po Valley.
Well, we were all down on the plain by this time.
You were all down on the plain itself.
Forley is on the plain. It's on. It's all on Route 9.
Yes.
Which goes through here. Mm. That's Route 9. There's the road from Rimini to Bologna. Forley is part of it.
Right.
It's just down off the hills. I kept hearing, obviously from home, I had a brother who at that time was in the Second Front.
Presumably he was preparing for the Rhine crossing.
He was, I'm not sure whether he was preparing for that, presumably. He was a corporal in the Signals. And I had a still younger brother who got his call-up papers round about this time. I have one or two cynical entries about this time, Turkey coming into the war, seeing which way their interests lay, and a week later or a few days later Egypt the same, and the day after Egypt declared war on Germany, their prime minister was shot for his pains. So it goes on. I mean, I noticed that 16th of February. Oh no, day or two before that, the entire battery, the regiment stayed in action, but our battery was taken out of action to mend and prepare roads for the next advance, so that the roads wouldn't collapse under the guns. We were going in lorry loads for hot showers at the nearest army shower unit in the town of Faenza, which is the next one to Forli. Sorry.
I'm wondering why you had to do the road mending, because I would have imagined that would be a pioneer or engineer task.
I think they were a bit short of that sort of labour. I don't know how many, you would know better than I, how many pioneers there might be in a typical infantry division, which we were, I don't know.
I would have thought normally a battalion's worth.
Really?
Or something like that, or the other possibility would have been to hire local civilian labour.
Yes, yes, one would have thought so. It may very well have been done as well, but we were, I've called it sapper road fatigue duty, the troops, so presumably the sappers were in
they
charge,
supervise,
we
yes.
were labouring. That's right.
I mean, what sort of damage was it? Was it war damage, or was it just
I think it's partly weather damage.
Caused by the thaw.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. It was possible to do it and necessary to do it.
Yes.
Because the ice and snow had gone. It had been pretty thick and pretty cold. All men on fatigues. 56th Division Commander General Whitfield comes and inspects our troop. He would choose the day when we were road mending. We heard that the Western Front in Italy was going well. I think they were breaking through the Apennines to our west. I mean, they run sort of northwest to southeast, and that front began to go well. Walk to RHQ and find the intelligence map just as I left it.
After how long?
Well, I'd been going there, I suppose, a fortnight before as the intelligence officer, and I went just as a visitor to have a look and found that it was not changed. Why that was, I don't know. But, I mean, entries of that kind in my diary are bracketed with bizarre things, like chaps getting drunk and on charges just as though they were in barracks at home. I went back to headquarters, RHQ, to talk to friends and to battery. I'd been in the battery headquarters at one time, RHQ for a long time. Now in a troop, I knew a lot of people. When you were not heavily in action, it was possible to walk around. You leave your colleague in charge of the troop and you go and visit. There was a social life of a kind when you were not in action. I stayed to an excellent dinner in the battery mess on the 15th of February. Next day there was a bit of a scare about an enemy attack, so we brought the guns back into action position. Road making was abandoned. The doctor comes and examines us all for infection, and my colleague, GPO Jack Davidson, my fellow officer, is totally humiliated to be found covered in lice. Poor chap, he has to shave all over, and then he's suddenly called to an observation post, I think probably for experience rather than anything else. I think it's a, yes, that's right, it's the Gurkha observation post. When he got back, he still has one or two lice. And then by Sunday, no more lice. But throughout all of this, of course, we were all living for correspondence. And I numerous records I won't trouble you with of letters from friends who were in the Czech Air Force, the Navy, and all kinds of things. And there was also a spate of availability of books. That's Concord, by the way, 11 o'clock. Spate of books coming through library provision. I can't remember how this was organised, but I was able to get hold of Jane Austen and so on, and quite a lot of Virginia Woolf.
Sounds like a period of marking time, waiting
yes,
for something
to happen.
Yes, it
was. We were waiting for something. We were waiting for the end of the war, but we knew that there had to be one more push to get the Germans back over the Po.
Yes.
I mean, they were still south of the Po. We were all weather-bound, Germans and Brits alike. the lot. And we were static, I suppose, for a much longer period than we had been since the beginning of the Italian campaign, except on that western front where stuff advance was still going on in the mountains. They had not broken through onto the plain as we had. Indeed, the plain is less marked up to the north northwest.
Were you able to make yourselves reasonably comfortable physically during that
time? Oh, we
time?
Were, yes. We were in farmhouses. We had log fires. We also had delightful contacts. I mean, at this time, I remember we were helping, sharing or visiting nearby an RHQ large farmhouse where there was a whole sisterhood of pretty girls. And the family, the family were on voluntary evacuation to their second home from Bologna, and these delightful girls, some of whom corresponded with us well after the war, they were tended to be students whose studies were obviously suspended.
It was a very large university in Bologna.
Yes, that's right. Yes, they're not the only ones I'd met. I'd met others in previous, you know, way back in the hills who were also undergraduates at Bologna.
Now you're getting close, this area, to the Republic of Spoleto, which was Mussolini's last refuge.
So was that what he called it? I didn't know that. But we were conscious that Mussolini must have his back to the wall in some sort of way. There wasn't much of Italy left. The question is whether he departed north into Germany, into Hitler's redoubt.
Or got himself caught as he did.
But,
I mean,
right.
did you meet any signs that there was positive support for Mussolini or his ideas?
No, quite the reverse. We were running into, and I've got an entry somewhere here, it doesn't matter the detail, but I got an entry about partisan... What's his name? Partisan Joe. We in Forli, we were buttonholed by a partisan leader, so say, who I think was really rather anxious to get some trading going, as well as being genuinely glad to meet up with us. That's right. And a friend of... I went with a friend two or three times to the home of this partisan. Also, I found myself going around giving lectures in turn before I left RHQ. Almost the last thing I did was to prepare a series of intelligence lectures on the German army. And I went round RHQ and the three batteries lecturing to them. Oh, here we are. Dinner again at 254 Battery. This is way back on the 9th of January. Drink at the house of Peter the Partisan with Jay, and went back two or three times, and I've put in brackets in my diary, suspect black market as well as partisan.
Presumably these lectures would have been based upon the course you'd done in the south.
You're absolutely right. This had only been a month or so before. Mm. That's quite right. You remind me. Yes, that's
right.
So
you were sort of passing on what you'd learned.
That's right. We find middle of January, that just to put the great bigger picture, the Russians take Warsaw, Krakow and Tilsit near the Silesian border. The whole thing is moving in on Germany.
Was there ever any expectation that you might just sit in position until Germany was invaded and gave up?
I've often wondered that. It didn't seem to be on the cards at all. I mean, there was determination to get over across the Po and to do our bit in the squeeze. We were not looking to the Russians to win the war. It was undesirable that they should take over most of Europe. And I think the strategy of the West must have been to get as far east as possible, and in our case as far north as possible. Partly, we were not conscious of it, but no doubt it was in Churchill's mind that the Russians mustn't take over everything. Um, trying to locate things back into February 1945. We're talking about catching up on correspondence. Skip all of this. It's a rather boring time, actually. The Egyptian Prime Minister is shot after declaring war. I mentioned that. Oh, yes, this was a time when my gun stopped.